Welcome to Business Second Opinion. Before we get started today, I wanted to thank a great sponsor we have for Business Second Opinion, Rebel. You may know their great products, but did you know they're working together to co-create a future without human trafficking? Rebel donates 2.5% of all net sales to Not For Sale to support regions of the world that are vulnerable to exploitation and human trafficking. Through impact sourcing, they help communities to thrive and prevent their vulnerability to trafficking in the first place. Their rallying cry is, "We are Rebel." Really fits. The 2.5% donation from them makes them truly revolutionaries for the greater good. We're so proud to be associated with them and help them tell their story. Please enjoy their great products and thereby support a cause we all believe in. Check out www.rebel.co to find purchase locations. Business Second Opinion is a podcast that digs deep to answer questions about business and business practice you may not know you need to be asking. But we believe you should be asking for the benefit of your understanding and your business's ethics and practice. In the process of answering them, we give you a second opinion, usually a contrarian opinion, but that's well-tested and proven to give the outcomes you really want without the nasty side effects. I'm Zach Swartout. And with me, as always, is Carol Sanford, our in-house positive contrarian, responding to big and hard questions with a radically different take. How's it going, Carol?
It's great. Good to hear you.
So, Carol, this conversation needs to come back to this idea of hierarchies and their usefulness in the workplace and organizational structure is something we've covered before, but I also feel like we need to cover again because there are instances of this in the world showing up. And so I think it helps us to show folks the same idea, but from a very different perspective and with different takes. How do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, when you talked to me about it, you were so on it's almost like an enraged roll about, oh no, this is coming back. You were so disturbed seeing this trend that it felt also really important to me to take on. But it feels like that people would need to know a little more about what struck you and made you want to have this conversation. Could you do a little background on that?
Yeah, totally. So Jordan Peterson is someone who's getting a lot of press these days from the kind of self-help world, but is also stepping into and talking a lot about two subjects that we've covered, obviously, one being hierarchies and two being personality typology. So he was in a debate recently with another philosopher named Slavoj Žižek, and they were kind of going back and forth. And one of the things that Peterson held up was this idea of dominance hierarchies and their rightness and natural order in the world. And so I wanted to bring that into our conversation because we cover it a lot from a business perspective, especially a regenerative perspective, and kind of re-examine that for our audience today. So how do we start thinking about that, Carol?
Well, you know, I resonate with what you're talking about because it's amazing to me how tenacious the idea is about needing hierarchies and the functional groups of dividing people up into categories. Historically, it was brought into the business world because of the work of Frederick Winslow Taylor, often called Taylorism. And when I looked at briefly the examples you gave that Peterson was looking at, their Taylorisms, which are being defended now as natural. Taylor's foundational assumptions, unfortunately, have now been disproven over and over again, but the whole idea doesn't really die, even though we now know the underlying assumptions are not correct. But the academians, like Peterson, bringing it back in, I think when I listen to them, they're most bringing it in to support the idea of capitalism being a right way to work, and raising the volume. And by the way, I don't think it's the only way capitalism can work, but I would agree that the way we look at it right now, Taylorism and hierarchies are strongly associated with that.
As our dear listeners will remember, we did a couple of pieces on the rise of Holacracy, which is a program developed by a computer technology founder based on the idea of getting rid of hierarchies. There were several articles in the Harvard Business Review about who was using a holacratic approach. But now we haven't actually heard a whole lot about that subject. It almost gives you the feeling that the new push for hierarchies is a push back to what people would call, or push back against what people would call progressive ideas. Really, they're just two forces pushing against one another. And that may seem crazy, but it does seem suspicious, the conversation of the value of hierarchies right on the heels of getting rid of hierarchies in that conversation.
Yeah. We've talked on this show before about these three forces that we usually only have two of them, one pushing against the other. But for today, I was thinking that what we might take as a direction is to actually go look at the myths that are behind hierarchies and I think keep them alive, where those myths come from, the error that's in them, maybe throw in a few case stories to show why and how these errors. And of course, we always have to talk a little bit about what to do instead.
Absolutely. Let's be concrete about what we know that's actually behind this resurgence.
So I see three myths, which I'd like to offer, and then take them one at a time and examine them. This will happen over a couple of episodes. The first one is the foundation of that I want to question is that efficiency is improved when you break tasks and actually work in general down into smaller and smaller tasks, which have different levels of difficulty and skill needed. And then you assign those out to people who you believe can handle more or less complexity and difficulty with each of the subtasks. So you get this picture of something we chopped into smaller and smaller pieces. And of course, when you see that scattering of all those pieces, you suddenly realize, wait a minute, you've got to have something that can see the whole or at least some parts of the whole. And so you assign supervisors, and their job is to manage the work overall and to link all the tasks.
Yeah, I was going to say that idea of breaking things down is pretty pervasive everywhere and is recommended by most consultants and actually even teachers. I mean, I feel that's where lists kind of exist everywhere. So that being a myth is an important one to tackle. But what's number two?
Well, let me say one more thing about how this relates to Harvard Business Review, then I'll give you the second one. I mean, there are hundreds and probably even thousands of pieces that are all about making hierarchies work better. So that's about the efficiency thing. And I've always, they all assume that hierarchies just have to exist and you have to train people somehow to have them work better. They never question that. So I think that's why I put that as the first myth, because it is unquestioned in our culture now. So the second one is the one we were just talking about with Peterson and the debate that he was involved in, which is that hierarchies are organic in nature. And so therefore, it proves that that's the way things are supposed to be. It's the natural way of things. I mean, apes are in hierarchies. Bees have hierarchies. In their case, they're always talking about it, though, as power hierarchies. The myth here, I believe, comes out of non-parallel analogies where we have some metaphors, the parts of it may fit, but much of it doesn't. And I think that calling it natural in every case is all coming from doing this transference with metaphor and analogy.
So this sounds like the same problem that we have with behaviorism, where rats were substituted for humans to understand human motivation, and they're seen as one and the same. But the proponents of hierarchies have added in forests and nature to prove their point, where I see, even without science coming into play, actually, is really problematic.
Yeah, that's what we're looking at today, right?
Yeah.
So let me throw in the third one here, and then we'll take them one at a time. So the third myth is that people are born with certain capabilities and cannot be advanced much beyond their birth IQ. Surveys have shown, most of these are out of Psychology Today, the survey showed that 97% of the population in general, but amazingly, 80% of leaders or people in organizational roles believe this, that people are born that way and with very little movement can they change. And the brain research tends to be done in a way that makes us interpret everything that way, because they say this is the way the brain is. They don't even talk about change over time. And all of that gets embedded into testing people, particularly for hiring them, but promoting them. And so even when you have a little bit of this new idea Carol Dweck threw in about growth mindset, that people can grow, managers are mostly thinking of building their skills, not changing the level of intelligence, the ability to have good judgment, and the management of complex thinking.
Well, I don't know about you, Carol, but that's all pretty depressing so far. So in the debate I was listening to, in some ways represents all three of these myths. Please, let's dissect them. Let's correct that. That would be following the first myth. Let's examine them with our systemic thinking approaches, because I actually want this peeled back and exposed much more effectively here.
Yeah, I know. You're the one who got us on this subject, which I'm coming to really love too. All right, then let's take the first myth and do what you're calling the peel away and expose. So that was about making something more efficient, easier to do with less energy, less cost, and therefore you would have to have supervision in all the layers it took to do this, if that myth is true. Now, you have to remember Taylor, I mentioned earlier, and Taylorism, when that was happening in the early 1900s, no one had any idea about systems thinking. They thought everything was kind of local. Even the global connections didn't really exist in people's mind. So they had no idea that people could actually grasp a whole and could make sense of their own individual actions in the context of that whole.
And that ability to see a system working was a capability that could be learned by everyone.
Right.
We know that from studies of watching children, for example, learn systemic thinking by working on projects without breaking them down into subtasks. So a concrete example is the Sudbury School model showed you that you could have kids aged 5 to 18 in very small, self-determined groups manage very complex projects to build whole buildings, including getting permits, approvals, buying the materials. But what they learned, or they learned what they had to do and figured out the things among themselves, and roles changed all the time. So, Carol, you've used more sophisticated expressions as idea in many companies, but how do they work?
You know, I think it's so hard for people to image how they work. And so it's one of the reasons I've always appreciated that Gary Hamel at least shows in the case stories that they exist. But I'm going to describe just a little bit, see if we can take it one more layer down. So the work systems that all of these are founded on is the idea that you dumb people down to the level you think they can handle. So first you have to get rid of that idea before you can even get rid of the idea that you would not need supervisors and external sources coming in and evaluating and maintaining control. Instead of, and here is the big shift that Gary Hamel still doesn't get either, he and the holacracy processes all are moving with the idea that people can do the work that was being done with supervisors without supervisors. And he's proven that to be true. But he's missing the major aspect that I know can take it to working in other than small businesses or privately held businesses and can go into very large ones. And that is a shift in work design, but it also requires building the capability of people for systems thinking. Living systems thinking. And that is learning to be able to image the working of an entire process from idea generation to production and out into the customer using it, and even beyond that into recycling. Now imagine if everyone in the company can do that kind of imaging of each product or product offering or service and can see how that flow is happening, no matter where you are in it. So everyone would be able to see and understand this entire role and understand they're playing a role in that process. No matter where they are in that process, they would know how it all ends up affecting the customer's life and the stakeholders like Earth. So what I've done in companies, that's hopefully gives a little bit of a picture, is that folks who were in previous roles of supervisors, instead of getting merged back into the group, which they mostly do in holacracy, they become people who are building the systemic capability. So they are resources to the teams who are working. And then you're able to add more layers of complexity that they can take on, including driving more innovation, which, I mean, true innovation, like we've been talking about in the last sessions, where you fundamentally disrupt markets. You can have, right now, you can't do that in most companies. But I did this in over 200 systems around the world. Unfortunately, most of them are in Europe and Africa, since people in the U.S. are so locked into Taylorism, it had less effect over time. There is more to it, for sure, than what I just said, because you have to design the work systems that people can deal with. But I'm going to leave that for you to go read in the Regenerative Business I released a couple of years ago, which not only gives the stories, but more of the details about how you pull this off.
So, Carol, I need some details on the principles of Taylorism to understand why people are so enamored of it. I have to remember that this was in the early days of the Second Industrial Revolution, when businesses were growing at an accelerated rate. So having someone say that we could easily do all this seemed like a great idea at the time, I'm sure.
Yeah. And you know, when anything is starting up quickly, like your own business, that you start looking for very simple things. So you can kind of see how people got hooked on Taylor. Let me at least give you the four foundational principles of Taylorism. And you tell me what you think based on your concern about hierarchies. First was the method of doing a task should be informed by a scientific investigation of the task, which basically meant break it down into smaller and smaller parts, and then you would understand somehow how it all rolled back up. Secondly, employees should be selected and carefully trained for a specific task, and of course, making sure they were the right people with the right kind of skills to do that. The third one is tasks should be have detailed instructions and should be subject to supervision. And the fourth one is management should evaluate tasks and formulate optimized approaches for the workers to follow. What do you think of those four?
Those look like they would work well with machines, but I'm less clear how they're workable on humans. You know, another idea about these would be great, actually. So keep going, Carol.
Yeah, you're right. That is what they found out. Taylorism was really great at breaking tasks down to small parts and requiring with supervision layers, but it actually never worked very well for people because, you know, actually people can see things that are not in the instructions it gave them, but they're not allowed to do it. It's where the old idea was, bring your hands to work, but not your head. So as more ideas came along, they kept trying to figure out how to solve the problem that they created by not allowing people to think. And they were not allowed to get involved in changing the way of working. And slowly what they did is more and more roles of hierarchy that they needed to have managing around. And that's actually where John Watson brought in behavior theory about how you manage all this complexity with people, because Taylorism worked well on machines, but not with people. But don't get me started on the behavior theory.
I won't, Carol. So anyone interested in knowing the effects of behaviorism on hierarchies can listen to episode 111 for more details. So maybe we go to the second myth. Hierarchies are organic and natural and in all of nature, proving that they are right and what's best for the world.
I think one of the places to start on this one I mentioned earlier, but didn't go into a lot of depth on, which is trying to use metaphors to understand something, which I believe is a lot of what Jordan Peterson was doing in his debate with, how do you say that guy's name?
Slavoj Žižek. I know it's kind of hard.
Yeah, thanks. Another person which we've heard say this is Elon Musk. He's saying, you know, go to first principles, don't start with metaphors and analogies. And many people may not know, but Einstein cautioned us about this also, because each of them in their learning to discover something understood you had to actually look at that entity and that system. And the minute you went to a metaphor or analogy to understand one thing from another thing, that you definitely start dragging across things that didn't fit. And you can't test that. It's like untested. Okay, we're like bees or we're like ants, right? Metaphors rid of us of the need to actually image the working of something alive and unique. And therefore, we start to generalize from it, which I learned in school, the minute you generalize, you're filling things with flaws and creating all sorts of traps. The one Peterson uses is, let's study lobsters. If you look at lobsters, they can teach us all we need to know. But of course, it's leaving out one of the core things, which is lobsters are not three-brain beings. They don't have a base brain, an amygdala, and the process of relating to others in the same way. And they certainly don't have frontal lobes. So they leave us extrapolating. And the last thing I'd say about this metaphor process is we tend to project ideas from one to the other. We try to fill in gaps where it doesn't quite fit and ignore anything that is unaligned with the aspects we're trying to prove. So when we try and form these ideas, we begin to rationalize them and to guide our thinking in the comparison. And then we begin to see what we're looking for. You know, the saying is really not seeing is believing. It really is believing is seeing.
And if you have a hand in the game of proving something is true, such as capitalists and industrialists who need a highly structured organization to do what they think is really all about controlling the game, you get even more blinded by these unexamined biases.
Well, especially with the form of capitalism we've evolved into, where what we have is an extract value. I know there are ways to do capitalism in a very different way, but Excuse me, that's not our subject today. All right. Let me take it another step, though, that I think may be helpful in understanding how we get off track with this myth. It seems to me that the argument that often gets left out when you listen to people that are fighting against hierarchies is the work that Paul McLean did at the National Institute for Mental Health. He talked about three different levels of brain, which I hinted at a moment ago. But he did the work showing that when the lower brain gets activated, as in a tiger is chasing you or you're about to get fired at work, that we lose connection to all the executive functions and we fall into a competitive survival of the fittest mode. So that does exist in us, but it's at the base brain. And there are still vestiges of that same fear of the tiger, which everybody we're competing with looks like, that are at work in us as humans. But the thing that gets excited, and this should give you hope for your depression, Zach, is that McLean demonstrated that there is really no longer, it's no longer actually true in evolutionary sense for how our judgment works, because we have a neocortex, you know, this upper brain that can discern what is real and what is imaginary. We can actually stop, take a breath, and we can determine whether it's a real tiger or we're really in trouble. But that comes from a different brain. Lobsters don't have that brain. The lingering part of that base brain that gave way into groups learning to function and work well together and to belong to a community or a tribe changes the dynamics, and we become less competitive. We become more communal and even eventually tribal with a bigger group. Now, what's interesting to me is McLean's thesis was that these constructs were all socially constructed based on the stage of the development of the brain and the ability it had to build an idea about what was happening. Now, all of that's happened in the last few hundred thousand years. If you go back, which are some of the examples, if you want to say it's natural with humans, those were an unevolved state of our actual human capacity. People did learn in more recent times to cross over all those tribal boundaries without war and without needing to dominate. Now, it always tends to flare up because it's not true that all people are developed. Unfortunately, McLean didn't live long enough to test some of his social dominance constructs, but he did live long enough to show us that it's likely an evolutionary question in social terms of communities' ability to engage. It was definitely not innate to the species.
I mean, even if you go and do some cursory research on Wikipedia and scroll through hierarchy and dominance hierarchies, especially in the sociological research, one aspect of that debate holds that there's no indicators tying hierarchies to biology. Only social agreements, which vary based on a nascent social evolution and generally social equality. And the more equitable a nation becomes in terms of equality, equity in prosperity, the less hierarchical they become. Even nations with kings and queens move their role to a more social role, such as Scandinavian countries. The monarchs there often do their own shopping, take on social roles of improving overall well-being of the nation, and so on. But when inequity rises, authoritarianism arises, and with it, as well as hierarchical dominance structures. So we might examine the relationship with this research between the industrialists who defend hierarchies and their desire to protect their own wealth. Although we have no research to prove that, but it does make you stop and think for a minute, doesn't it?
It does. It really does, the correlation. You know, our understanding of biology and hierarchies in nature were developed by Aristotle a very long time ago, and they haven't been examined since. And in Aristotle's day, there was no framework for the idea of evolution and that people could change in different eras over time. And certainly as a species, they would begin to have different capabilities. They're not fixed in time. But all our theories of hierarchy are Aristotelian, and we're still trapped in that era that created them. Do you have any examples, Zach? We're talking a lot of theory. Tell us a little bit about how you see this playing out.
Yeah, so as you mentioned before, there's the perennial example in Harvard Business Review of Gary Hamel's research into Morningstar and W.L. Gore, the company that makes Gore-Tex, actually. So you can look in the HBR articles from December of 2011. The article is actually called First, Fire All the Managers. In this article, hierarchies are claimed to be the least efficient, is basically what he's saying there. But mostly, he only provided case studies, which demonstrate that it's not organic It's a choice, and actually not a very good one.
Yeah.
Also, another bit of research that threw me that was the Whitehall studies that were actually conducted in the 1960s and 1980s that found essentially the dominance hierarchies more negatively affected folks at the bottom of them, in most cases causing men at the bottom to have 3 times the mortality rate as those at the top. So there's some pretty negative social consequences and social determinants of health consequences for those at the bottom. If what these studies say is true, it's really hard to argue that this is a natural order of life that would beautifully allow our species to flourish.
Yeah. I'm thinking about Hamill's studies. I read everything he writes. And I'm so glad that he's out there showing people that it works. But I don't believe that they really provide good alternatives, because they're more like what Holacracy has done. The people in the organization are working on the existing work and doing it without managed, flatter, just a flatter organization without managers. He does believe that we are conditioned to work in hierarchies. And I agree with that. I think a whole lot of it does have to do with this conditioning of, this is the way we're raised, and this is the way our first jobs are, the way our schools are. But there's also an experience that just flattening it is not enough. My experience is, and again, I've written about this a lot, that it's a change process that happens over 3 to 8 years, including building a lot of capability and redesigning how work flows.
So, Carol, what about the third myth you mentioned, that we are confusing hierarchies of complexity with hierarchies of higher power and power over others in a dominant structure? What are you talking about there?
Well, you can imagine when you hear someone like Peterson say, well, hierarchies are natural. What if it turns out that the hierarchy is natural, but we've flattened it out into the thing world where people exist, rather than being able to understand it as how the mind works and what we'd be able to see? So I call these, like, thinking about hierarchies complexity, or you might say they're hierarchies of the mind, and they're not at all dependent on somebody being smarter or stronger like the physical ones are, but they're dependent on our ability to grasp the world from different scopes or aspects in what I call in-term systems, an increasing number of terms we can think in to understand. Well, and let me whet your appetite about that, because I don't think that's instantly easy to grasp. Okay, we've got multiple minds. What does that mean? Well, the difference is really based on what we can see and think about. So if you think about yourself on any one day, and if it's easier to think about somebody else, because this one always bumps people a little when I say, think about the time that you're very self-referential. Everything is about you. We miss all sorts of clues and signifiers about what's going on because it's all about us. That is literally a particular kind of mind that collapses, and we can feel it, and we can certainly see it in others when they collapse into all about me on some occasions. Then you could move to a different level of mind where you go, it's not all about me, but wait, I'm a part of a community or a family you can start with, or a tribe or a neighborhood, and I take into account the well-being of all those around me. Suddenly, the answers you had around self-referential aren't complete enough. Things look different. What you care about changes. And we begin to see that we're all on one planet. We're in it together. We're interdependent with all of life. That actually is the third level, where what we're doing is moving out to the understanding that we're in a deep, complex mind, the ability to see the whole world working, not just our neighborhood. So we might call these three levels or worlds, the self, the proximate environment, and then the universe we live in. There's not just one level or one mind, but there are multiple levels, which if we consider and we learn to do it, you can learn to do this and say, self, we're being self-referential. How is this going to affect everyone else around me? And then you can get a community or group of people saying it's all for us. And then you can shift and say, wait a minute, what about the nation we're a part of or the planet we're on? You have to learn, though, to steward that mind, to ask it to come into existence. And we have not developed that capacity. We don't have a framework for doing it. And someday I want to do a whole episode on what it means to develop the mind and use frameworks to understand these different levels.
I'm actually not sure I can wait on that, Carol. It sounds pretty intriguing, and maybe the most intriguing of all. But it sounds like we have the idea mixed up here a little bit with the idea of hierarchies as a biological process or even a social process with the undeveloped hierarchies of potential of the mind. It sounds almost like science fiction.
I assure you it's not. So I suggest you keep your research going. I will keep mine going. And we will begin to explore this third myth in a lot more depth in the next episode. What do you think we ought to cover there? Anything you said this excited you? Anything you want to make sure we talk about?
No, I mean, I think really at the end of the day, this idea of conflating the thing view of hierarchies with the mental view of how we could use hierarchies to see different orders of things and different levels of things is really powerful for people. So I want to make sure we get that right, because I think that's an idea that's really powerful for people.
Great. Well, hopefully a lot of people care about that also and will join us.
Don't forget to email us and tell us about your organization and business practices. Email carol@businesssecondopinion.com. What worldview do you see yourself continuing to fall into? What aspirations do you have to think and work differently? Feel free to email us a question that we can speak to on an upcoming podcast. Let us know what you think of our show and its focus and content. And thanks as always to Numi T, one of the courageous ones that continues to question and examine themselves and their ways of working. Carol, tell me a little bit about what you think about Numi.
I was just in a conversation with Ogbed recently about the amazing work they're doing in regenerative agriculture with their supply system. And of course, they acquire tea leaves in some pretty fragile climates. And they have been working with their supply system in order to really create a healthy, vital soil that can regenerate itself, and increasingly understanding how soil works and helping their consumers like me come to understand it. So every time I drink a cup of their tea, I think about where that tea came from and how they're working on regenerating the planet we live on.
This has been Business Second Opinion.